The following message was recorded at First Baptist Church in Lyndale, Texas. For more great teaching or to find information about our church and when we gather, visit our website at fbclyndale.com.
On the panel tonight, it's going to be discussing these things. Obviously, David is here with us. Thomas, his expertise is going to tell us how he fought Caesar in Washington. And Matt Schaefer, one of our members. But Matt, give just a brief background of yourself. I know you served in the Texas House, and so just give a little bit of background so people understand what you're bringing to us as well tonight.
Matt Schaefer served 20 years in the Navy Reserves as an intelligence officer, served in Afghanistan. And when I came back from Afghanistan, I ran for the Texas House of Representatives out of Tyler in 2012, was elected in 2012, and served 12 years, so six terms, on the Texas House of Representatives down in Austin.
So I just really appreciated Matt, you've been a member how many years now? With us, two at least? Maybe three? Yeah. So just really appreciated his insight to the issues like this. So that's why I'm glad he's with us tonight. So let me just set the groundwork again to the table of Romans 13. What we're all agreeing on, Romans 13, 1 to 7, is that when we talk about submission, when that word submission is used, it's not equal or just, it doesn't just mean the word obey. It usually includes that. So I preached through that and I said submission is an attitude, a posture that we're to have that recognizes the authorities that are over us and recognizes our place under that authority and submits to that authority in a way that is seeking to and ready to obey. But there are going to be times that we can't obey. We'll talk about that a little bit tonight. But we still have a submissive attitude. So I use the issue David had even brought up in Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and how they said, "O King, we cannot do this." So they were their attitude, their submission, even in resisting doing what was being told, was still giving the proper respect to the authority that was over them. So we talked about, so we're coming from that. We clearly will talk about, we believe that there's spheres of obedience we'll talk about, spheres of authority we'll talk about tonight. Where does the authority of government stop? Along with the sphere of the authority of the family, the individual as well, you know, personal liberty. I don't know, we'll get into that. We're not going to get into those things. But there are different spheres, but mainly the family, the government, the church are the three that we're thinking of. So that's where we're coming from as we think about this tonight. And we're going to begin by talking about just defining our government. We've asked Matt to give us a little bit of defining of that, defining our government and the ways in which Christians can healthily affect change. But we have to begin with, you know, our government system is very different than Paul's was. They were under Nero, a Caesar rule. And as we talked this weekend, Matt, it's really not an easy answer of who Caesar is. In one sense, it is. But in another sense, our government's just a little bit different. So as we think about our form of government, that needs to come into play first as we think about these topics. So why don't you kind of give us a civics lesson?
So render under Caesar what is Caesar, to God what is God. So who is Caesar in our system? Well, it's interesting because next year will be the 250th anniversary of our Caesar. Have y'all thought about that? Next year is 2026, 250 years from 1776, there will be really a national spotlight on that anniversary. Many things. I'll get to go into do something at the Museum of the Bible. We're going to read the Bible all the way through from the Museum of the Bible in Washington, D.C. But what is government for us? And you can really look at it in the form of opposites of what we came from. So the people of the Bible would have only understood really a monarchy. They would have understood, you know, the Israelites in their own tradition, they would have understood tribalism at a very local level. When I was in Afghanistan, It was tribalism, okay? And your form of government in that environment is given to you. I mean, it is, you receive it. it's put upon you by force. You just receive your form of government. They believed in the divine right of kings later on. But what we have is self-government, okay, where we actually chose our form of government. So think about that. For all of human history, this was the first time that instead of sovereignty being sovereignty on top going down, this was sovereignty in the people going up. So I think it's instructive to go ahead and just read a little bit of the Declaration of Independence to get to this direct point. It says, when in the course of human events, it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with one another and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, they are endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure those rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. In a monarchy, under Nero, you did not have the consent of the governed. But catch what they talked about. They talked about how their rights just, you already had your rights from God. There were certain rights that you had to, you know, the Bible talked about private property, all these things, right to life, all these things. They just existed. And so they wanted to have government that just was there to protect those rights. So that was 1776. Well, now 11 years later, they're at the Constitutional Convention, right? And they're debating how they're going to put all this together. And you have the Federalist Papers, which were written, which was this public discussion of how we're going to do this. Is it going to be strong national government or strong states, right? Federalism versus nationalism. And James Madison really hit on the tension that we have in government that goes to this Romans 13 problem. He said, but what is government itself but the greatest of all reflections on human nature? If men were angels, no government would be necessary. If angels were to govern men, neither external nor internal controls on government would be necessary. In framing a government of men over men, the great difficulty lies in this. You must first enable the government to control the governed, and in the next place, oblige it to control itself. James Madison, Federalist 51. Well, then 12 years later, one of my favorite presidents, John Adams, is writing to the Massachusetts militia, and he says, because we have no government armed with power capable of contending with human passions, unbridled by morality and religion, avarice, ambition, revenge, or gallantry would break the strongest cords of our Constitution as a whale goes through a net. Our Constitution was made only for a moral and religious people. It is wholly inadequate to the government of any other. So we have this system. So God established all authority, and the way we got our authority established by God was a form of self-governance. And so to me, Caesar is now this room. All of Lyndale, all of Texas, all of the United States is Caesar. The people have the authority, okay, in a representative form of government. Not a pure democracy, of course, but a representative form of government that requires our stewardship and our participation. And that's why we have elections. And it all goes away if we fall asleep at the wheel. It is self-governance of men over men who are fallen, sinful, subject to avarice and ambition and all these things that the founders struggled with and worried about. And that's what we have.
We have a couple of minutes. You guys want to add anything to that, David?
I took too much time. I'm sorry.
No, you didn't. We got 3 minutes.
Yeah, that's all good. Yeah. you know, even thinking back to ancient civilizations, you know, it's always a balance between order and freedom, in a sense. Do you think in, in some ways the founders, as we think about this balance of order and religious liberty and freedom, in a sense, you know, some people look back at our social compact and said, religious licentiousness, expressive individualism, it's out of control. Obviously, we made a mistake 250 years ago. We need to rewrite the grounds of our social compact, and we need to clamp down more on order. Because look at, you know, transgenderism, look at all this. This is what liberty has given us. You know, maybe we should go back 300, 400 years ago when people had a Christian prince ruling them. You know, should we at this time rethink our social compact so that we can have order? Was there a mistake somehow that the founders missed? So how would you address people who say, you know, I think these founding documents, they're just not good enough. We need something stronger, a prince to rule us.
I think the system that was created is probably the best thing that we have this side of heaven. I think the problem is not with the separation of powers principles in the Constitution, the three branches, the federalism, that the national government would govern issues common to everyone in the country, and the states would get down into the weeds on the local issues. I think that is still the best system. The problem lies in the human heart and the sinful nature that we have, in that, like James, like John Adams said, this Constitution, it would be like a whale through a net if we don't have a moral and religious people. So maybe the problem is not the U.S. Constitution, but maybe it's in the pulpits. Maybe it's in the homes.
Yeah, and so a principle that's really good to think about for us as Protestants to even claim, because some people say, oh, that's a Roman Catholic doctrine. Well, no, it's a biblical doctrine. It's the doctrine of subsidiarity, that problems get solved at the lowest level. You know, the United Nations is the most ineffective body in the world, but a father disciplining his son, profoundly effective if handled well. So subsidiarity, you know, tribalism, as it were, that fathers ruling their own homes well, leading and guiding, then local governments, and then state governments, and then national governments, and thinking about whole continents as well.
So that kind of transitions into the sphere of authority, since that I think that's where we were going next anyway. So the family is a sphere of authority. I mean, that was the first thing that was created. It was the family. And then you have the sphere of authority of government that I talked about a couple weeks ago. When you, after, you know, the world spirals, the families do a horrible job of because of fallen mankind. It comes to the point that God brings the flood. They get off the ark. Murder had been the predominant sin from Genesis 4 through Genesis 6 before God brings the flood, and they he immediately says, man has got to govern himself, and there, and the main one thing is with the issue of murder. And then, of course, that progresses on, but we get into the church being a sphere of authority. So we have those spheres of authority. So the question is this: where does, and I think we all agree on this, back to Romans 13, that the main fundamental role of government, according to Romans 13, is to punish evil and reward or promote good. So where, what is the sphere of authority of government, and where does it stop?
Well, jump in there, because that's not exactly how we think of our, that's not how we describe our form of government. And I think even the people that are writing the Federalist Papers, they talked about restraining evil and things, but they would talk about restraining tyranny and promoting liberty, right?
Well, wouldn't tyranny be evil and liberty be good? I mean,
and I think that's the nuance of how the Bible describes the purpose. But then when you have a Christian heart, you've been redeemed, you've been transformed, as in Romans 12, then you have ordered liberty. You know, I would describe myself, I'm sort of libertarian on economic principles, but I'm not libertarian on, you know, prostitution and drugs and all these other matters, right? So we really do have to think about what is the purpose of government.
And I think you would have, obviously, protection. It's not that Romans 13, those two words cover everything, but they would be a wide net. So protecting the people, protecting the borders of the nation, all of those things are involved, I think, in that. Because whether people like to admit it or not, borders are a good thing. We see them clearly in Scripture. So what are those? Let's list those off. What is the sphere of authority of government? Where does it stop?
I'll give a brief example. The government's job is not to tell us how to parent, for instance. And my parental rights, my ability to parent my children and raise them up, it's one of those rights that's given to me as a Christian and as an image bearer of God. So the moment that the government would seek to encroach upon that is the moment that I would say, well, here's a clear violation of the sphere of influence. In Washington State, there's Senate Bill 5599 that ultimately said that if your child ran from you to receive gender-affirming care and were kept in a state-supported shelter, that state-supported shelter did not have to contact you, and they could give, quote, gender-affirming care to that child. You understand the ramifications of that for Christians in Christian homes, signed in the middle of the night. And so as a church in Washington State, we had petitions at the front door of our church on Sunday morning. Some people got really upset at us for this, but this was a moment in which the government had overreached and was breaking that sphere of influence, because we should have the right as Christian parents to parent our children in the way that we see fit. It's not the state's job to keep my child.
But you wouldn't say that whole cloth, would you? That well, and the way I see fit,
belts.
What if I see fit to, you know, obviously someone sees fit to abuse their child. That's out of the sphere of the authority of the family. The government mm-hmm. has that right. Right? I mean, those are big debated things. So, you know, we've seen court cases where a person believes that, you know, their children shouldn't see the doctor. And the court steps in to force them for getting transgender sickness. So there are some lines that are a little, you know, muddy in that.
But that's the struggle right now, even in the state of Texas. Our legislature has to deal with parental consent on vaccines. I mean, there's debate. Listen, there are some moral, religious opt-outs that you can do as a parent for vaccines in public schools. But like literally the school would have to send you a paper form. Like they had to have a debate on whether you could do that electronically, because the public schools wouldn't want you to have easy access to this, right? Because there's a whole debate about whether you should vaccinate your children. The same about library books, whether parents should have knowledge and authority over what book their child checks out at the library. These are ongoing real world issues today.
So that's why I said there's some gray issues in that as well that we have to talk through. And I think, let's just give a scenario. If I was taking my child and teaching them to go into Walmart and steal for me, that's outside the sphere of the authority of my family. Government can't step in. They have every right. So the government does have authority there. That's their sphere of authority, right? I mean, how do we think about those? If a church, let's use a church should, the government does not have authority over the church. But if someone sexually abuses a child in the church, that's outside our sphere of authority. We're to go to the government and let them deal with that person. We don't try to deal with that inside with our own type of therapy and things of that nature. You see what I'm getting at? So but there is a point that the government cannot overstep.
Yeah, but the government's coming very close, though, to how... Let's bring up that topic, sexual abuse inside the church. Very important thing. It's been a problem in Catholic Church, Protestants everywhere. But then there are processes on reporting. Okay, so yes, you know if a crime has been committed, you should report it to the authorities. But what if there's something below that where you're not quite sure what happened? Does the state of Texas have the authority to step into your internal processes? inside the church. And we're a lot of legislatures would step right in and tell you how to conduct your business in that scenario.
Yeah. Were you planning to go to Genesis 9? Or do you want me to? Yeah. So Genesis 9 is a great starting place in thinking about the government. And there's an interesting connection, I think, between Genesis 9 and Romans 13. Because in Romans 13, we're told the government is an avenger. So God set up the government as an avenger. But in the next chapter, he says, vengeance is whose? The Lord's. Well, whose is it? The government's or the Lord's? So in Genesis 9, starting in verse 5, about murder, he says, and from every man, from each man's brother, I will require the life of man. So don't murder. The Lord's going to require that life. Verse 6, whoever sheds man's blood, by the Lord his blood shall be shed. It says, by man his blood shall be shed. For in the image of God he made man. And it's for you, be fruitful, multiply, swarm in the earth and multiply in it. So we have, of course, this principle in Romans 9, this sort of establishment of government. There's a rule, you shall not murder. It's like the most basic rule of government. The government should care about life and death matters. And if there is murder, then humankind, whatever sort of early tribal form after the ark, the mankind, by man, the Lord shall require that life. There's also an interesting mixing. You can't just say, you know, this is a general secular principle, capital punishment, or the need to preserve life. The reason behind it is deeply religious. They are made in the image of God. That's why you do this. So even in the early government, there's a recognition of being made in the image of God. He is the creator. We are his creation. And from this religious principle, being made in the image of God, now there's the government principle, the existence of government. They care about life and death. And then we connect that to Romans 13, that evil and good, you know, they've been given the sword. What's that sword refer to? Life and death. That's a connection to Romans, or rather Genesis 9. And so the first sort of principle, I think you've even preached on this before, you say, I forget the exact term you used, a single issue. God was a single issue voter, as it were, in Genesis 9. It's the issue of life. That's why the government exists. So, you know, we can start at, we might say, that foundational principle and then to begin extrapolating out. Because I know we want to talk about COVID, you know, what was the government's proper role in that? Should they care about life and these sorts of things? So we may not want to transition to that yet, but yeah.
That fits right into that, though, because we're going to say, here's where it stops, so then how do we respond to that? But we not only could look at Genesis 9, Romans 13, but we could go to Revelation 13. Romans 13, Revelation 13. Revelation 13 is when government says, I'm God.
Yeah.
And, you know, God doesn't take too kindly to that.
Nope.
So life is foundational. I agree. We would all agree with that, right?
But what he's talked about with the death penalty, that's controversial. What you just said is controversial. There are Republicans who are ready to get rid of the death penalty in the state of Texas. And there are some in the legislature that would argue, like, what is the purpose of sending someone to prison? Many would say it's rehabilitation. Okay? And their focus is on rehabilitation. What others would say, one, you're protecting society, and two, there's a justice component that we're just punishing you. That there is a punishment component, and that's why I, you know, always supported capital punishment. But that is the principle that you outlined is lost on some people in elected office, even in the state of Texas.
Yeah, I mean, that's clear in some states where they don't want to even punish people by making them pay bail anymore in some states. So punish evil. Genesis 9 makes it clear that the government has the right, has the responsibility, I would even say, because it says, I require, not just the right, the responsibility. That's an even stronger statement, to take the life of those who take the lives of others. I've said time and time again that somebody who is unwilling to protect life, if, even in the womb, for example, they're not qualified to govern people outside the womb. Because if you don't care about life itself, then so anyway, go ahead.
Well, all these issues are very relevant right now because, okay, we have a very obvious example where someone's been intentionally murdered. The government says, no, that's wrong. But go down that scale of harms down to casino gambling, sports betting. You look at what happens with domestic violence associated with gambling, the financial ruin that comes to people, the organized crime that follows it in every state. And so legislators like me who opposed those opening up the state of Texas to casino gambling, I was always looking at it as the harm that it would do to the nuclear family. Okay? Texas is on the verge of legalizing marijuana, y'all. I mean, the governor vetoed a bill that would have basically taken a product out of convenience stores that kids can buy right now. And they're having to try to revisit that issue. And there's this libertarian component of it. But, you know, we legalize alcohol. But what about marijuana? And so, you know, it gets into this issue, like, you know, do we need, I always say, do we need more legal intoxicants out there? You know, talk to your pastor friends from Colorado, what has happened. Talk to doctors about what it does to schizophrenics and stuff. You know, alcohol's horrible as well, right? But we're having to struggle with this as a society right now. The role of government to restrain human behavior.
To restrain evil.
Well, and that's the very thing that, you know, coming from Olympia, I like to say that Seattle is kind of Bernie Sanders liberalism and Olympia is burn it down. Okay, it's just anarchy. We have an anarchy zine that we brought back from this most recent trip talking about free Narcan vending machines, okay, and just kind of an unrestricted...
Free what?
Narcan.
I don't know what Narcan is.
Is what people can take as a level of narcotics to it so that they don't necessarily die from an overdose, but it still keeps you high. I mean, it's essentially fentanyl. And so there is a means by which people can just continue to remain on opioids and stay on the streets. And the government is bent on continually providing resources that enable people to stay there as opposed to protecting people from those things. And I think that's where the sphere comes in, is are we actually protecting life or are we just continuing a status quo?
So part of what y'all are saying, I'm hearing this, is that a lot of what's in the sphere of the government's authority, they're failing to do, and things that are not in the sphere of their authority, they're overstepping and
absolutely
into areas. And this is human nature. Mm-hmm. So let's transition to that of how can Christians respond to government overreach? Now, we're going to end this by talking about, you know, what are ways that we can step up now. But how do we respond to overreach? I'll give you a couple of seconds to talk about that because you had that affect you up in Washington.
Yeah, so y'all had about 2 or 3 weeks of regulations down here, if I'm not mistaken, for COVID. It might have been a little bit longer. We had 2 years.
We never had any
years.
Church regulations from the very beginning.
Okay. Yeah.
Abbott did not require us to shut down. Oklahoma was much more open. And, you know, he didn't have anything at all, but Abbott had some, but go ahead.
So in Olympia, it had to be at least 6 or 7 months where churches were not allowed to gather, at least inside. And there were all these parameters where...
What does not allowed mean? They gave an order?
They gave an order. It was a guideline. It's kind of like Parlay from Pirates of the Caribbean. It'd be like mere guidelines.
Was it an executive order? It wasn't a law
from,
that was passed.
It was not a law that was passed, but it was from the governor.
Okay.
Okay. And you would be fine, much like in the state of California. It was the same way in Washington State. At first, you were not allowed to gather. And we were one of the first churches that opened up because at first, whenever you're thinking, oh man, this is a really, really big deal, and then you start realizing it's not as big of a deal as we thought it is. It's still a big deal, but you know, we need to think about this rightly. We're called to gather in person. And this is what it says in Hebrews, do not forsake the gathering of the brethren. And so we began to gather. And then they started placing stipulations on, okay, but you cannot sing, so don't sing. which is a ridiculous stipulation to place upon Christians, especially in this church, because y'all sing. We just had a choir meeting about that. We're told numerous times to sing in Ephesians 5, address one another through psalms, hymns, and spiritual songs. And so as elders, we had to make the decision, okay, what things are we going to abide by purposely to show honor to the government while at the same time abide by the word first and foremost, right? We're not going to be just outright angrily defying some of these things. We want to show a level of honor to the government as we're called to. What does it say in 1 Peter 2:13-17? It says, be subject for the Lord's sake to every human institution, whether it be to the emperor supreme or to governors, as sent by him to punish those who do evil and to praise those who do good. For this is the will of God, that by doing good, you should put to silence the ignorance of foolish people. Live as people who are free, not using your freedom as a cover-up for evil, but living as servants of God. Honor everyone, love the brotherhood, fear God, honor the emperor. And so we didn't want to cover up for evil. We wanted to make sure what we are doing is biblically sound. We want to obey the Lord first. So in line with that, yes, we opened up. We had the signs that the Washington State required on businesses or places where people would go about wearing masks. We did not enforce every single church member to wear a mask. We would set some of our chairs a little bit apart, but we still met together. Whenever I led worship or whenever I would preach, first, for a little bit, we had a silly little plexiglass thing in front of me so you could see all my spit as it came out. Those in the front row know. We had that because we were live streaming our services. We had to hold intention. We want to remain open as long as possible to spread the gospel because at this point in time, it's my belief that the government was overstepping and utilizing fear to control people such that there are still people in Washington State who wear their masks by themselves in their cars. It was our job to stand for the truth and contend for the faith, yet in such a way that showed honor to the powers that be. And so we had people leave us because of that. We had people leave us because we still said, you know, if you want to wear a mask, it's a conscience sake. We had people who left us because, you know, not everybody was wearing a mask, or we were saying that it was okay to wear a mask if people wanted to. At the end of the day, we had to make sure that first and foremost, we were honoring Christ as Lord. And then,
so where had they overstepped their authority? Would you say singing?
Oh, specifically with singing and also gathering. Specifically with not gathering.
What about communion? Did they put restrictions on that?
Oh, yeah, but we didn't follow that.
I mean, we still made
communion, but that's a good example. So with communion, we shifted the way that we did it, though, nonetheless.
I understand that, but were they telling you they didn't want you to do it at all?
Yeah. Okay. Yes, but we shifted the way that we did it, nonetheless. Instead of actually having, you know, we had leavened bread. Okay, we won't talk about that now, but we used to have that. Then we went to the little cups that you can open up with the little wafer on top.
Yeah, we did the same thing.
Yeah, we did that, but we were still not supposed to partake in communal meals.
Okay.
Or gather in homes, which we did.
Where did you see overreach during the COVID period, or other areas of overreach that you have seen that you believe government, whether it be in Texas or outside? What are some? When does government overreach? How do we respond to that?
Well, it's coming, folks. We're one Supreme Court vote away from the issue of, for instance, same-sex marriage taking on a whole new shape in our country. And what do I mean by that? people want to embrace same-sex marriage as a civil rights issue, all right? Well, how do we deal with civil rights issues under federal law in the United States? Go to the FBI website, and you will see that they have a criminal division for civil rights enforcement. If you now put same-sex marriage into a civil rights category, you are now bringing all the force of the criminal code into parachurch activities. What do I mean by that? Private Christian schools, private Christian camps, organizations that support, like even like Guidestone. I mean, you think of all the support ministries that are in place. They're not a church themselves, but they're adjacent to a church, right? They're they're right around. They're support ministries, parachurch organizations. Look at
Chick-fil-A. I mean, Chick-fil-A is another example of a business that's been really targeted.
Yeah, so the point is that if they're successful in enshrining this into the civil rights framework, then you're going to bow the knee or have a choice. Let's say you're a private Christian school or private organization, that you have a code of ethics, a statement of belief, that, you know, you're in a same-sex relationship. We're not going to hire you to be an English teacher in our private Christian school. Well, guess what? There are many people in our country who would say the FBI should knock on your door if that is the case. And certainly you should lose your tax-exempt status.
So part of what I hear you saying is that part of dealing with government overreach is to stop it before it happens, and that we need to be involved.
But the Supreme Court's already opened the door to it.
Okay.
With Obergefell. Now, there are many of us that are hoping, just like, you know, the judicial decision, the logic behind Roe v. Wade was so flawed. They were just trying to force an outcome, right? So they just made up, literally had phrases like penumbras and emanations. Well, nobody in law school knows what penumbras and emanations are. They were just pulling it out of their hat. Well, they kind of pulled it out of their hat on the Obergefell decision on same-sex marriage and talked about love and all this other stuff. It weren't legal principles. And so there's some hope that we'll be able to challenge that, and that Obergefell decision will fall. But it hasn't, folks. And you saw what happened with Roe v. Wade. Were we allowing tens of thousands of babies to be slaughtered in the state of Texas based on a flawed legal decision? You bet we were. And so we're going to have a day when the people in this room are still alive, where this issue of same-sex marriage is going to step right into all of our parachurch activities, and we're going to have decisions to make.
So David, what are your thoughts on government overreach, of how we respond? Obviously, as much as we can to prevent it, be involved to try to stop these things. But what do we do once Thomas calls you up? He's in Washington. He's like, what would be your counsel to him? What do I do? I've got these things. How do I rightly respond to the government overreach?
Yeah, how do you rightly respond? Well, there's the principle behind it of the government. They have a concern with life and death. So they say COVID's a matter of life and death, and they go to the extreme. You know, one example I like to think of is, you know, the government might say people falling down is a real big issue. We're concerned with the people in this room falling down and hitting their heads. These steps are really dangerous. And they could say, we want every citizen to wear a bike helmet at all times. And you have to, okay, so, you know, seatbelts. You know, I'm glad we have seatbelts. I think those are reasonable. I think making an American citizen wear a bike helmet 24/7, you know, every time they leave the house, that's unreasonable. So a lot of the things we saw with COVID is, you know, is this reasonable or is this unreasonable? And that's a negotiation we have to work out.
Is there evidence that what they're asking you to do actually works?
Yeah, yeah. Is this biased against certain industries, against certain organizations? So in Las Vegas, strip clubs and casinos were open and churches were closed. You think, okay, what's the difference there? I mean, obviously there's a difference, but why?
Yeah. I'm glad.
Why would you open one and close another? You know, is there an unfair bias? Are some people being targeted for some way? Is there reasonableness to health as well? So yeah, us wearing bike helmets all the time would help save lives, but it's not reasonable for us as well. So how do we think about overreach? Sometimes overreach looks different in every generation as Christians. So think about that seesaw. On one side there's order, the other side there's freedom or liberty. There used to be a time when the government was overreaching way too much on the side of order. And he said, 350 years ago in England in the 1640s to the 16, you know, up until 1689, there was a tremendous amount of persecution against Christians who would not be a part of the official state church. Those who were nonconformists, who left the church to form their own churches, and they were persecuted. Charles II took people into the Star Chamber, and if they wouldn't listen, if they were not a part of the official state church, I mean, you could be fined 30, 40, 50% of your income for not going every single week. And if you wouldn't listen, there were examples of him cutting off one of your ears. If he still wouldn't listen, if you're a pastor or meeting illegally, he'd cut off your other ear. And then if you were still insisting on meeting, he would cut off your nose because you were a stench to the land. And so in the 1646 Westminster Assembly, there's evidence of many of those men missing ears and missing noses because they defied the government. They said, we ought to have liberty to meet together as Christians and not be a part of the single state church. So they erred on the side of having, as it were, too much order. Well, now we're on the opposite end of the seesaw. There's too much, as it were, liberty. There's too much licentiousness. So we're in a unique situation as Christians to understand and try to figure out how to respond to government overreach in that sense.
But you would also say the too much order in that situation is outside their sphere of authority as well.
Yeah, it's still outside their sphere. For example, Thomas Helwys in 1612 wrote this to the king, James I. He said, "For our Lord the king is but an earthly king, and he hath no authority as a king but in earthly causes. And if the king's people be obedient and true subjects, obeying all human laws made by our king, our Lord the king can require no more. For men's religion is religion to God is betwixt God and themselves. The king shall not answer for it." So we have among Baptists this argument of, at the judgment seat, I'm not going to be standing next to my king or my government and they're holding my hand, helping me at the judgment seat. Every man is going to appear before the throne of God himself, and men ought to live in such a way with a clear conscience to best prepare themselves for the day of judgment. So let men be free and go to the churches they want to, according to conscience, seeking to obey the Bible. Now, we live in a very different context as well. So we think of, you know, freedom in a very different way.
Well, it seems to me you would have to start with the question of defining the thing that's happening. And is this something that belongs to God or the government, right? Because that's what it
Absolutely.
Says, right? So
yeah.
Render unto Caesar what is Caesar's, wanted to God what is God. So, okay, my daughter is under my authority, my wife and I together. Is it harming life? Is it harming the family? Then, you know, obviously the church belongs to God. So is it something that's affecting the church? Then you kind of put it into the category. This belongs to God. I've got my answer. This is something that's God has put into the sphere of civil government. Okay, who can I hire? Who can I let in and out of my grocery store that I own or my nursery that, you know, okay, where is it? You know, is this not church. This is not my daughter and my wife. This is over here. This is business. This is commerce. So to me, it would be helpful in these situations to do that. Now, where it starts to get difficult is these issues like same-sex marriage, because who defines marriage and who owns marriage? I mean, this is God's deal. This is his creation. This is his institution. And so to me, if I'm being asked to violate something that God has created, now I'm outside of the government sphere and I'm into, you're going to have to lock me up.
So there were a good amount of quote unquote conservative evangelicals who said during COVID that it's clear, it's Romans 13. If the government tells you not to meet, you shouldn't meet. There would be conservative evangelicals that at that time would have told you're wrong.
We had opposition where
so,
we were at.
But I think we're all agreeing that, hey, when it comes to that, people weren't being forced to come to church. They came to church if they wanted to. I think, you know, we didn't, you know, force people for not attending. We tried to disciple them during that time. But and you certainly didn't force people to come. And if we do gather, we have to do the things that the Bible regulates what constitutes worship. We're not worshiping tonight. We're gathering and having a panel discussion. This is not, I mean, in one sense, we're always worshiping, right?
We're not praising.
Yeah. Corporate gather worship. We're not, because in doing corporate worship, you have the proclamation of the word, you have the singing, you have all of those elements, the prayer, all of those elements that go along with it. So, but if we are gathering, and my point being is this doesn't constitute a worship service. And they can't, but if we are gathering to worship, we've got to do the things that do constitute a worship service. That's my point where I'm going. We got to transition because of the time we have left. So the last one is, well, what are some ways that the church can step up now? Because you've already alluded to the fact that there are issues even in the state of Texas. I don't think it's wrong. I think we talked the other day that if somebody's in a state that's being restrictive on things, you have every freedom and right to flee that state, right? And to seek recourse. I don't know the word I'm looking for. Do what?
Petition your government for redress of grievances.
Well, I'm just saying leave it. You can even do that. Say, you know, hey, I'm not staying in California. I'm getting out if they're going to do these. But not everybody can. But one of the things we need to do is everything we can as good citizens, Christian citizens in the state of Texas. How do we think about this regarding ways that the church can step up now? What are some things we're facing? What are some liberties that may be in jeopardy, both as a in the sphere of the family and the sphere of the church?
I'm going to begin my answer by saying, as someone who spent decade plus in public service and even longer in the military, you know, how much of my personal energy is given to this thing called government I can get my priorities screwed up. Our first priority should be to worship God, to be leading our families as men, being a part of a local church, okay? You're taking care of your family. You're being a father. You're being the spiritual head of your house. You're participating in your local church. Your energy starts there. Your checkbook starts there. If you haven't tithed, don't give money to a politician. That's Matt Schaefer 101, okay? So what I'm saying is that as red-blooded Americans who love watch Fox News and this and that and listen to the radio and yell at the TV, we can get our priorities out of whack, out of balance, okay? However, comma. This is a stewardship issue as I see it, because God has given us this government. We are the Caesar, so we've got to be stewards. It starts with being informed. Who is your city councilman? Who is your school board trustee? Well, it's probably an elder, but it's who are your local people? What's going on, generally speaking, in your community? Who is your state representative? Who is your state senator? Who is your congressman? Who is your U.S. senator? Who is your governor? And it gets complicated, man. We elect our judges in Texas. We got Supreme Court justices that handle all the civil matters, and then we got Court of Criminal Appeals handle. I mean, I don't even name them all. It gets really complicated. So being informed as a Christian, I think, is a big, big job. Having your eyes open, showing up to vote. Sometimes you go in to vote just to get an education because you see names on the ballot. What is the State Board of Education? Okay, I don't know, but I just voted for that guy. Right? That happens. One thing that's happening in a couple of months is every 2 years the Texas legislature meets and they end up having to make propose changes to the Texas Constitution. Now, I can get the U.S. Declaration of Independence and the Texas and the U.S. Constitution in this little bitty book. If I had the Texas Constitution in front of us, I'd have to have a book as big as the hymnal. It's big. It's packed full of information. Okay, because we went through Reconstruction, Civil War. We've had different. So our Constitution is big and clunky. So we have to make changes to it in Texas.
Because it shows all the changes as well.
No, just because it's that lengthy.
Okay.
And for instance, every time we raise the homestead exemption for property taxes, that requires a constitutional amendment. This November, you're going to vote on whether to raise the homestead exemption for property taxes. But here's another one that you may not be aware of. And I'm going to read this because this is literally what passed, and it's very self-explanatory. It says, Article 1, Texas Constitution is amended by adding Section 37 to read as follows. This is the proposed language. To enshrine truths that are deeply rooted in this nation's history and traditions, the people of Texas hereby affirm that a parent has the responsibility to nurture and protect the parent's child and the corresponding fundamental right to exercise care, custody, and control of the parent's child, including the right to make decisions concerning the child's upbringing. This proposed constitutional amendment shall be submitted to the voters at an election to be held on November 4th, 2025. The ballot will not have that exact language. The ballot, what you're going to see in the ballot will say, the constitutional amendment affirming that parents are the primary decision makers for their children. So on your ballot, there's actually going to be 17 different propositions to change our Texas Constitution on November 4th. So we will all have an opportunity, and there's going to be a couple of them I'm going to vote against just because I know kind of what's going on behind the scenes, and they're not doing things the right way, and they're taking money off the books, and they don't need to be doing that, in my opinion. But there's going to be some things on there that you're going to have to consider. That'll be coming up on November 4th. And that one right there that I just read that goes to your rights over your children, to me, lines up perfectly with biblical principles. And it affirms and strengthens existing laws in Texas regarding parents, because you have a hierarchy in your law. You have a statute that the legislature passes, but if the statute violates the Constitution, any local judge can say, nope, didn't count. So you're getting an opportunity to put language into the Texas Constitution that strengthens the role of the parent in raising their child. And I think that's a good thing.
The real question comes to, when is a good time to plant an apple tree? 2 years ago, right? And there are states, Washington, Oregon, California, there are states in which the reason that 5599 was able to pass in Washington state was because already at the age of 12 or 13, minors were able to give their own consent to receive medical treatment aside from their parents, because that had already been undone in Washington state as far as a parent's right. That's why it's important for us to know this right now ahead of time, so that we can continue to live in a free state and exercise our duty as Christians with our sphere of authority in a sense that God has given us to care for and steward our families well. And I really appreciate what David said earlier as far as bringing up that doctrine of, you know, what we do now, both as parents, as grandparents, and as individuals in our community, tends to matter much more and have an even far greater impact for the future than any of the big proposed things that we could think of doing. And so to come to that question, one of the best things that you can do is vote, and then also pray for your elected officials. Pray that they might come to know Jesus.
Well, you can speak, too. Right. In our system, you can actually criticize the government.
Yep.
Do so in a way that's not personal. And I'm talking to myself here because I get pretty hot-blooded on Twitter. But, you know, you've got to speak. And we can. You know, John MacArthur would have talked about the church being the conscience of the nation. Well, if we're quiet all the time about matters of public concern, then we're not being that salt and light in that respect. You know, you go into all the world and spread the gospel. Don't stop at the Capitol steps. Go on into the Capitol and speak.
And evangelize.
Absolutely.
I mean, we have the ability to limit government, and that's what you're saying. These are the times to step up to say, hey, we're going to make sure that we limit your authority doesn't go beyond this. David, do you want to say something?
Yeah, I think it ties together with what you talked about this morning about love is the fulfillment of the law. So our confession of faith says all Christians are under obligation to seek to make the will of Christ supreme in our own lives and in human society. And it says, means and methods used for the improvement of society and the establishment of righteousness among men can be truly and permanently helpful only when they are rooted in the regeneration of the individual by the saving grace of God in Jesus Christ. Martin Bucer, one of the German reformers, along with Martin Luther, but Bucer, it went to Strasbourg, and he wrote a little book in 1523 called The Instruction in Christian Love. Instruction in Christian Love. You can read it online. It's really short. It's only two chapters. You can read it in one sitting. He talks about this vision of society, that it is about love, that we were made to give each other, give ourselves to each other in love. And what we see with sin is the opposite has happened. The breakdown of society has happened because we don't want to love. We're selfish. And the only way that can be turned around is through the gospel of Jesus Christ, Bucer said. And so when we think about, even if the world's going to hell, you know, we can say at least, well, we can win the school board at least. Yeah, that's good. It's good. It's the doctrine of subsidiarity, that we can at least have an influence here. But the only, even if we win all the elections, in 20 years it won't matter if people aren't saved as well. And the only thing ultimately that's going to change society is if we're changed into the image of Jesus Christ, if we are truly, by the Spirit, loving one another.
And those of us that are believers, we should be, and if we are Caesar, as you say, then we should be, when we go to vote for candidates, when we go to vote for legislation that we have an opportunity to vote on, like these amendments to the Constitution, we should be asking the question, begin with, is that, how does this fit within the sphere of authority? Is this God or is this Caesar's? Is this something I should limit them from having or give them? Is this going to promote good and restrain evil? And those aren't always easy. But sometimes when we go, and I'm not going to push this hot button on you, because I know if I push it too hard, you'll probably want to go off on it. We don't have time. But
you're limiting
there are
him.
There are some
they
good.
They want you to do it now.
There are some good conservative Christian people who will vote this fall because of, as we were talking about the other day, because of the Second Amendment driving their vote, as opposed to whether who they're voting for really is living a life that restrains evil even in their own home. And I think a candidate who doesn't restrain evil in his own life and in his own home, you need to be really careful about giving them power of any kind. And that's a hard issue because, we had two candidates that ran for president this last time, and neither one of them had a real strong track record of restraining evil in their personal lives. So these are not always easy decisions to make. We have to be as wise as serpents, innocent as doves. Let's start with our own homes, our own lives, loving one another, our own church, the gospel being spread so that we can get to the day that we have candidates running that it's not that difficult to choose between. I don't know if we'll ever get to that point. But we need to constantly be thinking through a biblical grid in how we vote and not a... just simply, how is this going to personally affect my wallet? How this is going to personally affect other things that may not necessarily be as important as the issues of evil and good and what is God's authority? Any other thing you want to say as we wrap up? A minute or two. Thank you, Matt. I so appreciate you. I know both of our men do as well. Pastors here, it's particularly what you said earlier about, hey, number one thing that matters is your home and the church and worship. That's where it needs to start. I would say that if God has gifted you, like I said a few weeks ago, to be involved in in the political realm, praise God for that, because they're servants of God. And we need more true Christians serving in that way. But we've got to be really careful that we don't forget the fact that what is going to transform the world is the gospel of Jesus Christ. Amen.